Glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife with our guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. And so as we visit with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions about wildlife do you have? Join the conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, maybe even a photo, to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry, and listeners out there. It's great to be back. I wish I was in the studio with you so we could interact a little bit more, but COVID will eventually disappear, I hope.
I hope so, too. Well, we had another unexpected turn on the wolf hunt in Wisconsin, and maybe you can explain what happened.
Well, holy cow, Larry, the wolf situation is such a swamp with ins and outs and twists and turns and whatnot that you really have to stay tuned almost daily to keep track of things. But, you know, I guess to recap a little bit, back to last winter in early January when the wolves were taken off the federal endangered species list again, that triggered a Wisconsin law that I believe was passed in 2011 that mandated a wolf hunt when the wolves were removed from whenever the wolves were not on the endangered species list. And I think the framework for that hunt was something like November through February. So while there was still time to get a hunt in earlier this year, the DNR took a conservative approach to that and said, holy cow, this is just too rushed. We'll plan an orderly progression to a hunt this fall, coming up very soon. But that didn't sit well with some hunting interests, I guess. And as you probably recall, an out-of-state group based in Kansas sued the state to follow that 2011 law mandating a hunt. And they found a federal court judge in Wisconsin to support that suit. And the DNR was forced to rather hastily hold a hunt last February and late January, February. And the result, of course, was for a variety of reasons, including weather conditions and wolf behavior at that time of the year and some changes in reporting requirements and a couple other things. The problem was that hunters were far more successful than most people thought they would be or realized quickly enough, and the quota was dramatically exceeded. And that set up a whole chain of events with various groups being concerned about over-harvest impacts on wolf biology and a whole host of other things leading up to what was going to happen this fall. And that, the notion of a fall hunt, got batted around before the Natural Resources Board and in the media and so on. And the end result was a contentious board meeting, NRB or Natural Resources Board meeting, a month or so ago, that with plenty of testimony, again, some of it coming from out-of-state hunting interests, despite the recommendation of the DNR for a quota of, I think, 130, they came up with a quota of 300 and directed the DNR to proceed with a hunt with that quota, which would begin on November 6th. Well, in the last few weeks, there have been a series of legal actions, lawsuits filed on behalf of Wisconsin Chippewa tribes, on behalf of other interest groups, and in some cases, animal welfare protection groups, in some cases, people interested in wolf management, putting pressure on to modify that decision. And lo and behold, just within the last week or so, the DNR came out with a position that the hunt would begin on November 6th as planned, but with the quota reduced back to 130 animals. And that quota then would be divided between sport hunters and the tribal allocation. I think, let's see, I've got the numbers here somewhere. The actual allocation will be, where are we at here? 74 allocated to state licensed hunters and 56 set aside for the Ojibwe tribes. And that represents a very unusual deviation from following Natural Resources Board recommendations or decisions. But in this case, I think it was the right thing to do. And the hunt will proceed if legal actions don't get in the way. So we're looking at a wolf hunt with a quota of 130 beginning on November 6th. And I suspect it will be tightly controlled, as were the hunts 6 or 7 years ago when the quotas were met and the season closed very efficiently. So
yeah,
that's currently where we stand, but there's a whole lot of legal posturing and way too much politics involved in wolf management right now, in my opinion.
Yeah, Jay in Appleton has something that directly relates to this. Jay, comment?
Good morning. Hi, Larry, longtime listener. This is the first time I ever called because of this issue. I am not a hunter, but I know a bunch of guys who participated in that wolf hunt. And the story I got from them was that they harvested and had the animals, and they delayed taking them in to be registered so the hunt would stay open. And I think if I remember correctly, they harvested many more than was expected to be harvested.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, is that a common practice? Because I thought, boy, that's just the wrong way to go ahead and try and manage our wolf population or any population. So.
Yeah.
Well, there are opportunities within the hunting framework for all manner of inappropriate or unethical or perhaps even illegal activities that could be viewed as suppressing the harvest facts or delaying closures of season and so forth. Fortunately, that I believe that rarely occurs. Generally speaking, most hunters, I mean, we're talking about a huge group of human beings here. So while I can say that most are ethical and follow the rules and want to do the right thing for wildlife conservation, there's always a segment that do not. The problem that you're referring to last year, Jay, was, as I recall, at the last minute, via another action by the Natural Resources Board or a segment of it, it extended the time that hunters had to report their kill. So instead of it had to be by, you know, close of business on the day the animal was taken or the day after or whatever, it gave them more time. And since the harvest was proceeding so rapidly, it's likely that if people delayed the registration, whether it was intentionally or just because they were trying to get home or get out of the woods or whatever, I don't know. But that potentially, as you suggest, contributed to more animals taken than would have been under the previous regulations.
Yeah. Jay, thank you so much. Looking at some other issues, I think Brian has a question for us from Genoa City. Brian, hello.
Yeah, hello. How you doing?
Good.
Good, good. Yeah, anybody with two brain cells and access to the internet knows that chemtrails are not a conspiracy theory, they're a conspiracy fact. I just wonder if any studies have been done about the barium, strontium, aluminum that's been, you know, getting dumped on us for, you know, well over a decade now.
In terms of infecting deer?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The wildlife. You know, the wildlife in general. I know. I'm not sure why the governments are doing it to us. Make us sick, you know, lower the population. But I'm wondering if it's having an effect on the wildlife as well.
Larry, I think because I'm on a phone connection, I didn't quite catch the first part of that in terms of what Brian was concerned about being put in the environment. Can you help me out on that?
Certain chemicals or metals that exist in the environment due to perhaps pollution or things of that nature, has that had an impact on, for example, a deer herd or other animals?
Well, I think since the beginning of time, so to speak, there's always been concern about environmental pollution, and you don't have to look too far in the news to see what's happening on the California coast right now with petroleum products being introduced into the environment and causing all sorts of problems for fish and wildlife resources in California, But there's a whole litany of things, from heavy metals to pharmaceuticals that we simply flush down the toilet and end up in the aquatic environment, to road salt, you name it. We as humans continually add things to the environment, and there's no question but what there are some negative effects. Most of the really bad stuff, like some of the pesticides we were using, like DDT and PCBs and things like that, that caused a lot of problems for birds, have been presumably removed. So yes, I mean, Brian raises a good point, but there's nothing specific right now that I'm aware of that's affecting the deer herd or any of the other marquee wildlife species in the state right now that are in the midst of all sorts of management controversy.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Owen in Wyawega will go to you. Hi, Owen.
Hello. Hi.
So, hi.
I know here in Wyawega, we don't really have any wolves that I know of that hunters have reported to me that they see here in the woods. But you go a little bit north of me, and you really hear, and to the west of me, over towards, you know, a little bit by Plainfield and whatnot, you hear these stories about large deer populations that have been somewhat eradicated by wolf impacts. And I'm just curious if there's been any studies on the actual diminishing deer populations and wolves directly correlating together and creating this lack of deer population. And also, I'm curious to know if there's been any studies on property values and how they diminish based on the availability and ability for hunters to actively hunt deer and get large yields on their deer hunting.
Okay.
Well, the short answer to the question is there is no question that wolves do eat, among many other things, deer. And you know, Larry, your group of hunters up in northern Wisconsin are a good example of the kinds of changes you've seen in deer numbers, partly attributed to wolves, among other things, winter weather conditions, habitat changes, hunting pressure, and so forth. But I think that, and I guess I'd like to hear you chime in on this, Larry, is mm-hmm. that part of the issue with the presence of wolves is that the deer are wise to this, and they don't spend a whole lot of time in the middle of an activity center for a wolf pack. So that the presence of wolves and the distribution of packs on the landscape tends to shift deer distribution around as the deer try to avoid contact with wolves. So part of it is, yes, some deer are actually killed and eaten. Some deer simply move out of that area to try and get to the edge of the pack's activity or stay out of harm's way, so to speak. But wolves are just one predator among many that the DNR has information on in terms of what the predator or the predation load is on the deer herd. And that includes coyotes. Black bears are a very efficient predator on fawns, and bobcats and a few other odds and ends. So, yes, there is some impact of predation, but there's also some impact from highway mortality and a whole host of other things. But the bulk of mortality sustained by the deer herd in any given year is still a result of the hunting season. And as far as property values are concerned, I've heard a few people say, you know, our hunt club, we just don't see any deer anymore because there's a wolf pack in the area. I don't know that that's affected property values very much. And I would think that you could point to a much more negative impact of chronic wasting disease, so that one would think that property values for recreational wooded property, say in southwestern Wisconsin, in the hotbed of chronic wasting disease, would have been diminished, but that certainly doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah.
There are other factors that add to land value in that area, and there is still deer present even after 20 years of CWD. So I don't think the property value issue has been a big problem to date.
Yeah, I think if you look at deer mortality, the number one deer mortality is hunters, and then second probably is automobiles, and third is probably chronic wasting. I forget the number of deer an individual wolf will take, but even with if you do the math on it, if there's like four, how many wolves are in the state now? 400, something like that?
Well, it's probably closer to a bit over 1,000 after reproduction this summer. But if you take a round number of 1,000 or 2,000, and the number of dead deer necessary to sustain a wolf in the literature is usually quoted at around 17 or 18, but make the math easy and say 20 deer, but they don't eat only deer. So 20 deer per wolf, even 2,000 wolves, we're only talking about 40,000 deer. And, you know, that barely stacks up to highway mortality and some other causes. So
Yeah. The
problem is it's not evenly distributed across the landscape. The deer mortality obviously occurs where the wolves are, and they're not found statewide. So
there we go. Thank you so much, Owen, for that question. Appreciate it very much. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. Tyler Ditter is our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist from UW Extension. Great to have him back. And you can join in, too. Question or comment, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Michael in Wauwatosa, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry and Scott. I was going to ask Scott to speak on the population dynamics between the wolves and the deer, and I think you kind of touched on that. I have a wildlife biology background and a forestry background, and I've got a property in northwestern Shawnee County, and I, as a hobby, I've been planting trees for years, mostly oaks, and every single tree, oak, sugar maple, red maple, you name it, I have got to buy wire and put cages around these trees because their population is so high. And the only time I see or know the fact that I know there's wolves out there is I see them on the game cameras, but I have never seen a dip in the population of deer, a change in their behaviors. They might be a little more skittish, but the deer population is as high as it's ever been. I can't raise trees. My property value is diminished because, you know, they're cleaning out everything in the woods. And, you know, I go hiking on the North Country Trail and the UP and parts of Schwamigan Nicolet, and I see what a normal wood should look like, and mine is just denuded.
Yeah.
You can't have enough wolves out there for me.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a point of view that we hear on the County Deer Advisory Committees. I'm actually the forestry representative for the Dane County Committee, and we hear that from some of our landowners here, too, where, just like the wolves, the deer are also not equally distributed on the landscape. So there are areas with extremely high populations and areas where they're relatively scarce. If you are in an area where those high populations exist, it's very difficult to produce some types of vegetation. I don't have any young hardwoods on my property here in Dane County because they get taken out pretty quickly. Same thing with all the oaks on my small property up in Price County. They're all nibbled down to the point that they look like shrubs. But in neither case there are my properties large enough to have much of an impact by hunting. But my advice, Michael, I don't know how many acres you're managing, but you're a lot better off to cast your lot with a group of hunters to reduce that deer population than you are trying to rely on the local wolf pack that covers a huge range. I don't know whether that appeals to you or not, but, you know, folks are always looking for a place to hunt where there are good deer populations, and you have some control as the landowner over not only who hunts, but what they harvest and how many they harvest and so on. So dealing with deer by wire cages or tree guards or repellents or all the kinds of tactics that are used to prevent deer browse is a tedious, expensive proposition. So if you can add a more vigorous element of hunting to the environment there, I think you'll find better protection for your trees.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate the call. Matt in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I'm actually wishing we had more wolves in southern Wisconsin. I'm a produce grower in Dane County, and I lose between $3,000 and $5,000 worth of product every year. And we put up 10-foot-high electric fences, which the deer still seem to either run through or hop over. And the amount of damage as the season goes on, it just goes up. And the amount of hunting that occurs in this particular area has gone down over the last two decades to the point where the deer herd is out of control, in my opinion. And we've tried working with the DNR to get permits to reduce the population. The downside is they give you 2 weeks to fill half of the tags that they give you. And the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is trying to improve sanitation, does not allow people that aren't employees of the farm to be on the farm where the produce is growing. So it's like a catch-22. Here's some permits, but the federal government says you can't allow third parties in there killing animals in the areas where you're growing produce. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but something really needs either a longer hunting season in the fall, gun deer season, or a stronger emphasis on getting rid of the does instead of so much buck hunting.
Yeah.
So, Matt, I would appreciate it if you would make email contact with me. As I indicated, I'm on the Dane County Citizens Deer Advisory Committee, and we very frequently hear from both sides of the argument. A case like yours where you're being heavily pressured by deer, but also on the other side of the case, people who are trying to desperately to find a place to hunt within the Dane County, the metro unit surrounding Madison, which I suspect you're in. So if you're willing to give me an email, it's just srcraven@wisc.edu. Let's make contact and talk about this a little bit. I think that regulation you're talking about not allowing hunters onto land producing produce sounds bizarre and archaic to me. So maybe we can dig into that a little deeper, too. So yeah. Anyway, if you're willing to make contact, I'm happy to try and help you out.
And what's that email again, Scott?
srcraven@wisc.edu.
There you go, Matt. I hope you'll follow up with Scott. He's in a position maybe he can make a solution to this issue for sure. Thank you. Gene in Twin Lakes, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gene.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Oh, I have a question. I'm sorry, I should have done it right away. Would you believe a call came in just as I'm talking to you? I have a question about bats. We had two incursions of bats. We have a lower guest bedroom, and my son's sleeps in it occasionally, and other guests. Thank God it didn't appear the night the guests were there, but he felt something on his cheek in the middle of the night, and it was a bat walking across his face. So he managed to get it out of the house, but because it's a walkout basement. I'm wondering, on two different times, we've had somebody check our roof to look. Do I ask you, or who do I ask?
About bat-proofing the house?
Yeah.
Well, there are commercial enterprises that handle some of that, but whether you found someone in the past who really was knowledgeable about seeking out the kinds of very small cracks and crevices that allow bats access to a home, and it only takes a crack about 3/8 of an inch wide around flashing or soffit vents or a whole host of other things that all have to be checked. Once the access points are identified, then the actual bat proofing is not particularly difficult. Is they're not rodents, so they don't chew their way in or out of a house the way a red squirrel might. So it's not particularly complicated, but for the last few years, since the onset of white nose syndrome has grossly depleted our bat populations, there have been a new set of regulations designed to protect bats, actually. that limits the timing during the year when these exclusion or bat-proofing tactics can be implemented. And you're coming up very quickly on the end of the bat activity period here. Fall is being extended greatly by this stretch of warm weather, so you have a little bit more time when bats might still be active. But as soon as it gets cold, we have a killing freeze. There's no more insects flying, which occurs below 50 degrees. Then you're out of luck until next spring. Now, the good news is I would suggest that you contact the bat group at the DNR in the Madison office. Go on the website and search bats on the DNR webpage, and you'll get in touch with the folks who can give you the up-to-date recommendations on what to do, when to do it, and how to do it, and I think you'll be able to solve that problem. It doesn't sound like the several individual bats that you mentioned probably indicates a particularly large colony, so I think your problem is entirely solvable, but I recommend you get a hold of those folks at the DNR and get their current advice and the regulations.
I mean, they can get through a hole the size of a dime. So it's a pretty small, I mean, you got to find those spots and caulk them up or whatever. Well, thank you, Gene. Appreciate your call very much. We had an email that I wanted to bring up from Tom in Wausau, because he also sent a photo, and this is of a chipmunk he found one morning last week in the middle of his garage. It was as if it was frozen in place. He swept it outside thinking it looked so alive that it might still run off. It didn't, but a few hours later was not where he left it. And he wonders if it was due to recovery or becoming food for another creature.
Well, I'd have to say yes. In other words, we'll never know. There are certainly many things that would have snatched a chipmunk just sitting in an open driveway, from a crow to a raptor to a host of other things. But I looked at the pictures, Larry, and it certainly did look alive, but it may not have been. And if he swept it out, it's possible it had been trapped in the garage there for an extended period without food or water, and may have been comatose, if not dead. We'll just never know. But yes, once he put it outside, it was hopefully it recovered and scampered off. But I'm a little suspicious of that from the pictures. I think something else snatched it up.
You could join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Luann in Madison next. Hi, Luann.
Hi. I was wondering if any wildlife trades are in the works. I remember in a previous program hearing that, I think it was ruffed grouse were traded to bring wild turkeys back to Wisconsin. So I was wondering if anything else like that is possibly going on right now.
No.
So the question, Larry, was, are there any reintroductions in progress or planned in the near future?
Where the DNR might trade off. She used, Luann used the example of ruffed grouse for turkeys. Are we, do we have anything like that going on?
No. The short answer, I think, is no. There have been some recent efforts to augment the genetics of our remnant prairie chicken populations in central Wisconsin with some birds from out-of-state populations. But I think most of those kinds of efforts have hit a screeching halt with COVID. And most of the low-hanging fruit, the reintroductions of trumpeter swans, for example, or wild turkeys, have taken place, and the elk, for that matter, have taken place over the last several decades and have been, for the most part, very successful. But I'm not aware that there's any immediate consideration of other things that have been extirpated over history coming back. And some of the recoveries that we're enjoying, you know, more loons, more bald eagles, and so forth, actually took place on site. In other words, the populations grew and increased from what we had here, like the wolves, for example, as well, rather than by bringing in animals from out of state.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it reminds me There are some species we're never going to see anymore. U.S. Fish and Wildlife declared 23 species extinct recently, including 11 birds. Was there anything unexpected on that list, Scott?
No, but the sad one for me was the ivory-billed woodpecker. That was the poster child for that announcement. And, the ivory bill, which is very similar in appearance, size, and so forth to our pileated woodpeckers, was one that, over my career in at the university and working there, there were fitful reports. There was somebody in the Arkansas swamp saw a pileated woodpecker, or there was a recording mentioned a few years ago, or maybe they were seen in the wilds of central Cuba. And so there was always kind of that glimmer of hope that, holy cow, somebody's going to find one of these things. But at this point, with that announcement, hope has been abandoned, and the ivory billed will continue only in museums where there are specimens on display. So that was a little sad. But the other things on the list, and there were a variety of taxa of wildlife represented, were all a bit more obscure than the ivory bill.
Yeah. Let's go to Paul in Presque Isle next. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm going to revert back to the deer story because I was working back in the wolf story. I was working back in the yard when I heard it. I live up in Presque Isle, and my question is, what is, and I'm an accountant, so I kind of know the answer. What is the math situation with wolves in terms of number of deer in the North Woods versus the number of wolves? My understanding is, let's just assume there's 2,000 wolves and each one eats 20 deer a year. You're talking 40,000 deer in the north, just the north half of the woods. That to me seems like an insignificant number in terms of the whole herd. And my argument for deer disappearing up here is that a lot more urbanization has gone up here, and a lot of deer have become urban deer, rather than out in the public lands. But the deer herd, we've been up here for 25 years, have not seen the deer herd reduce at all. And seeing an occasional wolf is a wonderful thing.
Hmm.
Well, you're absolutely right. The math doesn't necessarily add up, but it can add up in local situations. So there are certainly places where there's a fairly large and very active pack where deer numbers have probably been impacted, in part because of mortality and in part because the deer have changed their behavior. But overall, you're correct. If you take the northern third of the state, and it's not 40,000 deer that are consumed, that's a worst-case scenario, playing with the math a little bit. And we just went through that exercise a few minutes ago. So it's a smaller number of wolves, and they eat a lot of other things. So you're correct. Relative to forest management, habitat fragmentation, urbanization, especially around lakeshore properties, winter weather, things that affect deer in the North Woods that don't necessarily affect deer in the southern part of the state, those probably have more impact on deer numbers than wolves do. But wolves are a factor, and they're a factor that stir up pretty strong emotions. So that's just something we have to live with.
You know, wolves, they have about a 5-square-mile area that they call home, more or less, if I'm not mistaken. And just the experience in our group of people that hunt on the National Forest, when the pack, the wolf pack that's there, when it's in our area, the deer population is way down because I think they just move somewhere else. And when the pack moves, the deer population seems to increase in our area. And you can almost set your watch by it.
Yeah, that's certainly true. There are places in the North Woods as well as anywhere else in Wisconsin or in the country where deer have adapted, as the caller mentioned, to the urban situation, and they're either being fed, which is not a great idea, or they're just finding our gardens and landscaping. Hey, this is a pretty good deal. We don't seem to be hunted here. We can tolerate the dogs and cats and whatnot, and they do very well, and they're very visible. But overall, over the last few years, there's been considerable concern, especially in the hunting community, that deer numbers have been low enough that there were a number of seasons where there was no antlerless harvest allowed, and that caused some consternation. We've kind of gotten out of that hole with some consecutive mild winters and some conservative harvests. So things are a little... The problem, Larry, it depends entirely on your viewpoint. And that's one of the challenges for wildlife management. You can ask person X, what do you think of deer numbers? Oh, my God, there's way too many of them. They're eating everything I try and grow. They're eating my oak trees. They're eating my produce, whatever. I just as soon get rid of them all. And then you can turn to person Y right next door. Oh, they're beautiful animals. And, you know, my in-laws like to hunt them, and I'm just not seeing as many as they are. You see where I'm headed with
yeah.
this. It's just a real challenge to try and corral popular opinion in any kind of consensus. But it's the same thing with wolf management as well. You know, if you live in the North Woods and you're dealing with these animals, your perspective of risks to your family dog, or whether they're real or perceived, or just what's going on out around your house, are very different from someone from my neighbors here south of Madison, where they have the luxury of thinking about wolves as a, you know, as a magnificent creature of the North Woods, which they are. And gee, wouldn't it be great to hear one howl someday or see one run across the road? And the thought of being concerned over the fact that there are 1,000 or whatever scattered across the North Woods causes no particular anxiety at all. So it just makes for a real challenge. And when you throw the politics in,
yeah.
then it really gets muddy. And I mean, for me, that's one of the most discouraging things that I've seen over the past few decades, is the rise of the influence of politicized wildlife management, when in fact we employ and trust some skilled wildlife managers who are hired to do these things. And seeing decisions on how many of this or that is going to be harvested, or whether there's a season or whether there isn't, done through the legislative process is very disturbing.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife with our guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you listening in today. I wanted to mention the Wisconsin Science Festival is back this fall, October 21st through the 24th. It's a great event across Wisconsin and for people of all ages. And I'm kind of excited that I get to be part of a talk all about mushrooms in our state. I'll talk with a panel of experts, and we'll look at the roles that fungi play in supporting and threatening even important Wisconsin habitats and industries. And my part is on October 23rd. We'll take a closer look at the wild and robust world of mushrooms. Registration's free. You can attend in person or online. And you can just go to wisconsinsciencefestival.org. Fungi, the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's on the 23rd. Go to wisconsinsciencefestival.org. And we have Elliot in Milton with a question, and let's go there. Elliot, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I lived in Alaska for like 8 or 9 years. I'm from here in Milton, Wisconsin. But what they have up there is a roadkill lottery for moose that get hit. And I was curious if there's anything like that, or has there ever been anything like that for deer in Wisconsin? Because it's when you see so many on the side of the road, it's just a shame you don't get to use that harvested meat. And
yeah.
So, yeah, that was my question.
All right. Thanks, Elliot.
Well, that's an interesting question, Elliot. There are a couple of ins and outs on that. There are certainly many roadkill deer, but unfortunately, they're not as regularly picked up or removed as they once were. In fact, they're often left to decompose so that the meat loses value rather quickly. In the case of a moose, or in some of the western states, an elk, we're talking about a much bigger carcass, potentially, not that deer damage can't be serious to a vehicle, but if you hit a moose, you've got big problems. And there's a substantial pile of meat there. So the lottery system allows that to go to some use. Even though the animals are not picked up regularly, it used to be possible, and I assume it still is, to contact your local, your county DNR office and speak to one of the wardens or the wildlife manager. And they used to maintain a list, and it could be sportsmen's clubs wanting a deer carcass for a game feed, or just some individual who would like to utilize the venison. And they go down that list as carcasses become available, and then, you know, get them to the people on the list. So that may still be a possibility, but remember too that deer, as I said, are a much smaller animal than a moose or an elk, and if they're hit pretty hard by a vehicle, there may be so much damage to the carcass that there's really not as much usable meat there as you might think. As a hungry graduate student, I occasionally got a roadkill deer from my DNR colleagues, and remember they dropped one off and said, "Hey, we got one that looks pretty good." And I tried to dress it in my driveway, and oh my gosh, it was, the impact of a speeding vehicle on a deer carcass that might look like it's intact, it was pretty well
ruined.
Pretty well mushmash inside, and was not usable at all. So there may not be quite as much waste as you may think there, but if it's something you're interested in personally, check with the DNR folks and see if they're still maintaining a list. And of course, someone who hits a deer can claim it by making the appropriate phone calls with the sheriff's department and the DNR if they want the carcass that they have hit.
I had the same experience with a neighbor who wasn't a hunter and had a deer that had been hit by a car and asked me to butcher it for him. And it looked pretty good until I got this hide off, and then it was like, oh my goodness me.
Yeah, the trauma is just awful, and not something that's very appetizing if you're thinking about creating food. Yeah. And maybe, by the way, that's something we can talk about later. With all the deer that are going to be taken legally by hunters over the next couple of months, there's going to be a lot of venison available to be consumed in Wisconsin.
There is indeed. We can talk maybe about a little bit about preparing that food. Scott and I have taught back. No, it's been way back a few years. a wild game cooking class, which was a lot of fun, and so maybe we can talk recipes a little bit too while we move along. Elliot, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Bob in Claybanks wondered if there have been any studies comparing CWD in areas with and without wolves. And, of course, the big areas for CWD, the biggest area is also the area where there isn't any or very little wolf activity.
Yeah, that's the problem there. But I would refer Bob to getting some of the periodic reports from the Southwestern Wisconsin Deer Study, which has just been wrapping up lately, where they've radio marked hundreds of deer in the Southwestern study areas, in an area where there are a lot of deer, but a lot of CWD, but also other predators. And they have quite a bit of information on the interactions amongst what the predators are doing and what the deer are doing based on radio telemetry. So you might find that interesting. But there's not a great deal of overlap, enough to give, I think, any meaningful information on whether or not. I think the obvious question is, did deer get those debilitated deer as they're in the final throes of CWD? I would expect so, but there just, as you pointed out, Larry, there isn't much overlap.
And where would he go again for that information?
I think his search for the DNR website for the southwestern Wisconsin deer study will turn up. They put out periodic reports through the internet on what they've been up to, and I think he can probably track that down.
All right. Jamie emailed that they've been putting out table scraps for foxes that come regularly. Should they stop feeding as winter approaches so they don't become too dependent? They live in an agricultural area with scattered woodlots.
Well, I fully understand, you know, why people get attracted to this kind of thing. Foxes are lovely animals, and you know, if there's something you can do easily to, you know, so that the fox family shows up at 4:20 every afternoon and picks up a few scraps, then I understand why people find that attractive. But in the long run, habituating any wild animal, particularly a mammal, to human food resources is not a good thing. It's not a good thing for the animals themselves. I wouldn't worry that much about the dependency issue. Foxes are quite capable of mousing during the winter and finding food items. But just that you get an animal that's conditioned like that, and then all of a sudden they show up at the porch of the neighbor's place where they don't know what's going on and think, uh-oh, it must be a sick fox, and it doesn't go well for the fox. So I think it's best to wean them off that. See them when you can, but don't interfere with their normal behavior.
Mary in La Crosse has something for us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a couple things about the roadkill deer options. In Trempealeau County, you contact the sheriff's office and you get put on the list, and then they just kind of go down the list and call people.
That's
great. The other thing is, when I worked at a nature center in Minnesota and we would get roadkill to feed the eagles, we never messed with cutting them open. We would take out the back strap as far as we could and remove the limbs and then just never touch the gut cavity at all.
Good idea. Very good idea. Those eagles were eating very well.
Mary, thanks very much. Appreciate the call. So in Trempealeau County, you call the sheriff's office and you get on the list. And that may be true in other counties. It's worth checking with your local county sheriff to see if that is in fact the case, if you're interested in that. Let's see, Kevin in Escanaba, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good, appreciate the call.
I noticed up in the Upper Peninsula in particular the last few years, there's been a steady decrease in the number of hunting licenses for deer in particular. It used to seem to be a huge tradition back into the 50s. You'd have to wait hours just to get across the Mackinac Bridge if you're coming up from the Lower Peninsula and, of course, up from Wisconsin as well, since we're just across the border. Do you think that the I don't want to say the popularity, but the tradition of hunting, especially among younger people, has, and the decrease in the number of licenses that are issued, has decreased the number of harvests? And should that be equated into all of your mathematical analysis in the management of the herd itself?
Yeah, good question.
Well, there are a couple of things to consider there, Kevin. On the one hand, there's a lot of concern nationally that hunting license sales have been on the decline. A cohort of hunters is aging out, and not enough young hunters are being recruited to take their place. There are many programs across the country attempting to address that, with things like Learn to Hunt programs and facilitating hunter education and all sorts of recruitment tools. So that's one issue. The other issue that is of some consideration is that as you look at the harvests for deer, they've remained pretty stable. even in the light of reduced license sales. So there's been no immediate major influence of that. And that's in part because, and it's the same thing that I think affects what you're seeing in terms of traditions and, gee, what happened to the traffic tie-up that used to
happen,
used to see on the bridge. And that's that in states like Wisconsin, hunting opportunity is far greater than it was. For example, when I started hunting in this state in the 70s and 80s, we used to see what you're talking about. Traffic on the interstate headed up north was like no other time of the year. Opening morning out in Iowa County, west of Madison, we'd wake up at the farmhouse for breakfast, and it was a steady stream of lights heading out into the fields and woods. Now we see virtually nobody, and the traffic rush has declined. And I think part of the explanation for that is hunters now have hunting opportunities literally from, in Wisconsin, mid-September until, in some areas, well into February.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick break. We can talk some more about that after we take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Scott Craven with us till 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Questions for him, you can give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo, that'd be kind of cool as well. Matter of fact, Scott, we had a couple of photos. Wonder at some pups. And Mark wonders if these are coyotes. Can you see those photos?
Well, I'm checking right now. Let's see. Where is this? Do you know where the photo? Northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, kind of a cool photo.
It is, and what I'm looking at is the face of the larger animal, the parent animal, in the top of that hollow log that has the eye reflection. And I mean, you can't see the ears very well, but it looks like a fairly narrow, rusty colored muzzle, and to me that looks more coyote like than wolf like if that's the basic question.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. I think that's probably a coyote. Michael in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Michael.
Hello?
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm actually in Milwaukee, but I live in South Milwaukee, and I was out of state for 5 years. So I live in Grant Park in Milwaukee, in South Milwaukee, and we have a lot of deer. Is there any CWD in Milwaukee County? And then I have a question about Professor Shaka Shiri, okay?
Okay.
I think Milwaukee County is in the southeast. I'm trying to fumble for a map here for survey. Just a second, Larry. I think I can come up with that. I'm pretty sure there probably is CWD there, and if there isn't, it's probably because no one's looked at it if the animals are not being harvested. So let's see. Here's our no. All right. So Milwaukee County is listed as being in the ongoing disease surveillance as far as CWD sampling areas for this coming year. So I suspect it has been discovered in the county. Whether in Grant Park specifically, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
But your local wildlife manager could certainly tell you that.
Yeah. And you had another question, Michael?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually a retired physician, and I haven't seen any deer that seem to have symptoms of CWD, and I see a lot of you in the park. The other question I have is, Larry, are you going to have Bassam on your program in the immediate future?
He was just on the show maybe a few weeks ago. He retired from the university, and it was kind of a retirement show in a way, although I expect that at some point he will be back. But he's retired from the university about a month ago, and he is going to be very active in a lot of things. So I think if you go to his website, scifund.org, that's still going, and he is responding there. You might just, if you've got a question for him, you might just want to shoot a note to scifund.org, Michael. There you go. Thank you for that, for those questions.
Hey, Larry, could we fit in a couple of comments about the weather situation?
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to, you know, mention people are, there's nightly reports now on the progression of fall color, and people are always interested in that. But the real issue right now in Wisconsin weather is that there's really been no substantial or sustained cold up in the north part of the state yet. And that hasn't pushed many birds south. That's, of course, concern to waterfowl hunters and people who are waiting for woodcock to be migrating and so forth. But that hasn't happened, and it looks like, from what I can see on the weather forecast, there isn't any freezing weather for some time yet, and that's going to mean a longer growing season. I'm still picking all kinds of tomatoes and raspberries and assorted other things, which is a good thing. But what I'm hoping is that this delayed fall season still means we'll actually have some fall weather and color and not the sometimes sudden and abrupt change to winter. The ongoing drought is still a concern. Lots of wetlands around me are all but gone. It's going to be hard on amphibian populations. And I'd like to see some, I'm hoping for some substantial rain and a slow progression into winter. And this will give people more time to prep for winter wildlife issues that they can anticipate, with vole problems or rabbit problems or unwanted house guests and that kind of thing. And there's also plenty of time to gear up for the bird feeding season, although many folks, including me, do feed year-round now. But if you don't, if you're just kind of getting your feeders out, this is a good time to clean and sterilize them, dry them, get them up in place, hit those seed sales, and get a good supply of bird seed on. In fact, now that I think about it, bird seed is one of the few commodities that I've not heard any of the scary reports that it's going to be in short supply. So I don't think you need to hoard sunflower seeds, but you can get a supply in while there are good sales on, pick up a few new feeders and get out there. The one thing, even though it's been dry, holy mackerel, the nut crop is incredible this fall. There are black walnuts everywhere and good crops of acorns. My chestnut trees are loaded. So for some things, as in all cases involving natural history, some things are very good for some species and some plant communities. Other problems are not. But, you know, you have to play the hand you're dealt.
Let's take another call. Dick in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I actually live in the township where Scott lives, down in the south end. I have a small farm. My son and I have noticed some coyotes, individual coyotes, in the paddock where we calve in the spring. And I think with an individual coyote, the cow would certainly fend them off. But I'm curious about pack activity that might be more of a threat to those animals. And I'll have a second question then about badgers in the area as well. So I'll let Scott go ahead and answer that first one first.
Well, the first question, Dick, is kind of, and I, how you doing? I haven't talked to you for quite a while. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. You know, I'm not that far from you, and our resident or local pack of coyotes has been very vocal over the course of the summer. We only kind of hear them go through the backyard when we have the windows and doors open, and sometimes they're extremely vocal. We know they're here, and then they're gone for a few days. You're certainly within the range of activity of those animals. So there's no question that there are plenty of coyotes around. And the fact that you see an individual, in fact, now that I think about it on my own property, I've never seen more than one at a time. But when you hear them talking to each other, so to speak, at night, you know there's plenty of them. So seeing one doesn't mean that there aren't a lot more around, and whatever steps you feel you need to take to protect your livestock, whether it's, you know, fencing or getting somebody in to try and call in and remove some of those animals, I think that's probably prudent.
All right. And then you had a question about badgers, I think, Dick.
Well, I've noticed the number of burrows out in the middle of hay fields, and some of the neighbors have claimed that they've observed badgers. I've never seen a badger myself. Specifically, I've observed woodchucks who do some of that or things like that, but I'm wondering if Larry might comment about, or Scott might comment about what those burrows are likely to be, or how one would ascertain whether it is a woodchuck or a fox or a badger in terms of what that burrowing activity is. These burrows are about, I'd say, 10 inches plus or minus in diameter in terms of the openings.
Well, first and foremost, you know, badgers are found statewide. I wouldn't say they're common by any means, but they're not necessarily rare either, but they are rarely seen. I've not seen a live one in the state in the 50 years I've been here, but I've seen road-killed individuals, and people have sent me lots of pictures and accounts of badgers around. So they're out there, but holes in the wide open spaces, as you pointed out, the primary excavators are woodchucks, fox, and badgers. There are some clues you can glean from a burrow. One is the shape. Fox and woodchuck burrows tend to be basically a round hole. Badger burrows, because they're such a flattened animal, so to speak, the burrow usually has more of an oval profile than the more round shape of the other animals. In addition, if there's any prey items around the burrow, remains of prey items. I'm not going to say there's a, you know, pile of dead animals, but there might be a bird wing or a bone or something like that, then that's an indication that you're dealing with fox, coyote, or badger, not woodchuck. Woodchucks are rodents and vegetarians. So that's another clue that at least eliminates somebody. And then in addition, with that dirt plume that the animal kicks out, there's usually some tracks available. And with a decent track guide, like Mark Elbrock's Guide to Mammal Tracks and Sign, or the Peterson Field Guides, you can usually figure out who it is from the tracks or the presence of a hare. And some people will put a bit of a wire, sharp wire, like a little piece of barbed wire, near the burrow that will catch some loose hairs on an animal and determine it that way. And, of course, the foolproof way, if you're really curious and you've got a burrow that's very active, put up a trail camera on it, and you'll find out exactly who's living there. So
there you go.
Yes.
Thanks, Dick. Carol in Hazelhurst, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Yes, I'm wondering about the status of the wildlife killing contests that are held in Wisconsin. Are they all legal? And if so, what's being done to stop them?
I haven't heard about any killing contests, as you call them, which usually deal with something like coyotes, or you get a lot of publicity from things in some of the southern states, rattlesnake roundups and coyote hunts and assorted other things. But that just does not seem to be a big issue in Wisconsin. And it's not particularly popular either with hunters in general or with the public. So even if something's going on, it's probably very low profile. And as you point out, some of those issues are, well, I won't say illegal, because harvest of some of those animals is legal. So if it's being done in a competitive sense, it's more of an ethical problem than a wildlife violation. So I don't think that's anything to lose sleep over in Wisconsin.
Dave in Price County, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Lambo Dave, I feed deer in the winter and sometimes in the summer, a mix of cracked corn, soybeans, and oats, which I think is okay. But my wife eats a banana every morning, and we usually have an orange, and then we have, you know, I have a mango or half a mango. And I'm wondering if it's okay to mix up. I cut them up into little tiny pieces with scissors, and I mix it in with their regular deer feed, banana peelings. I wonder if it's okay to feed fruit peelings to the deer mixed in with their regular mix.
And you're in Price County.
On the Flambeau River, right.
Well, I'm trying to decide how to handle this one, Larry. I mean, you know, biologically, you know, hey, a little fruit with your food probably isn't harmful, but I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that I don't support deer feeding, no matter what the food stuff is, for the variety of detrimental effects it has on the deer herd. I realize it's still popular in some cases. I realize that most food marts and gas stations in the Northwoods still have big piles of corn. But with CWD continuing to spread and the problems related to that and other issues, it doesn't matter what's being fed. I don't think it's advisable. So enough. That's all I've got to say on the matter.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Scott in Pelican Lake. Hi. You there, Scott, in Pelican Lake?
Well, Scott and Madison's here. I don't know about Pelican Lake.
Well, let's go then to Bill in Oregon emailed to ask if the DNR or other groups are interested in repeated Dane County bobcat sightings.
Yes, I suspect the DNR is interested because bobcats are one of the animals that's been heavily studied with the aforementioned Southwestern Wisconsin Deer and Predator Study. I think they'd be very interested in repeated sightings, and that's something that just give the folks at the Nevin Fish Hatchery at the DNR office, talk to the local wildlife manager, and make that report.
Steve wonders if there's such a thing as a silver or gray otter in Wisconsin. He saw what he believes to be such an animal while he was fishing on the Menominee River, the border between the UP and Wisconsin. He knows otters are related to mink, and mink do indeed have what is referred to as a silver-blue pelt. Any relationship there?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, in looking at lots of pelts at the fur auctions and assorted other things, I've never seen a whole lot of variation amongst otter pelts from that, you know, rich chestnut brown.
But when they're wet, they look silvery or gray.
I've seen them as, you know, as they're swimming by and their hair traps air, and they get shiny because of the wetness of their guard hairs. And depending on the light, they certainly do look silvery on some cases. So my guess is I'm with you on this one, Larry. I'm guessing this is the condition or light angle or whatever of the otter being viewed rather than actual hair color.
Mark emailed, he noticed huge differences in trout populations between rehabilitated stream sections and degraded trout stream sections, at least in the Driftless area. How does the stream bank improvement increase trout numbers, and when can we start? Oh, he was talking about birds again, too, but we'll just pass on that and go with the trout question.
Well, I mean, certainly a degraded stream where the banks have caved in and there's erosion and whatnot, or the brushes encroach so much they're impossible to fish, it does impact trout populations, and that's why both the DNR and Trout Unlimited projects in the Southwest have paid such big dividends in terms of increases in trout populations in managed streams. So I guess I would urge Mark to get in touch with Trout Unlimited, and they have some very nice publications as well as their magazine that talks about all their regional activities and what streams have been rehabbed and which ones haven't and what the results have been. So, I mean, there's no question that a well-managed stream where they put in features like rock riprap or so-called lunker structures, which are overhanging logs, and it creates undercut banks and places where the trout can hide and avoid predation, get out of the sun and all that kind of stuff, and create more food resources. There's no question that good management produces more fish. So,
You had you were telling me the other day, and I've kind of forgotten the whole gist of it, but there was a study on birds in windows that you saw recently.
Oh yeah, there's been a lot of publicity in the local papers in the last few days about, well, this is a huge problem nationwide, but there's an interesting citizen science opportunity here in the Dane County area and perhaps elsewhere as well, in combination of the university, Madison Audubon Society, and several citizens organizations. People can get involved by going to madisonaudubon.org. But this window strike group, people go out and routinely survey some of the larger municipal buildings, campus buildings, and so forth, and see what they're finding for dead birds that have collided with windows. You know, big sheets or expanses of glass are a major problem for migrating birds or for resident birds. Unfortunately, you know, I think anybody that feeds birds like I do and has some large windows, sooner or later they're going to find a dead bird on the porch or the deck and say, oh, man, that was my favorite downy woodpecker or my favorite rose-breasted grosbeak. And it's a feel-bad situation, but it's a lot more than that. The national estimates are some 600 million bird mortalities caused by window strikes. Now, I don't know how accurate that number is, but the point is it's a very large number. Lots and lots of birds killed in window strikes. And there are things people can do about that in terms of, you know, hawk silhouettes and other things that can be placed on the windows or the reflection of the window deadened, especially during migratory periods like now, to minimize those bird strikes. So I think people could probably Google bird window collisions and get all the information they ever wanted. But it's a big problem, and even though it may only be one or two birds on your deck over the course of the year, you multiply that by everybody's deck, and it's a big problem.
I also wanted to mention the DNR has a great new hunting regulations booklet out this year. We have a link to it on our website at wpr.org/Larry. I've had a chance to look at it. It really looks good.
It's really nice. It includes a lot of species, so you're not going to a whole lot of different books. But one of the things I wanted to plug about it is right at the outset of it are the changes going into place this year that hunters have an obligation to be aware of what the regulations are. In this case, there are some changes that affect waterfowl hunting, and there's one about use of buckshot for fur-bearing mammals and some things that people need to be aware of if they're going to hunt.
Yeah, and again, I have, of course, you can go to your DNR website, but we have a link at wpr.org/Larry. Well, Scott, it's always a pleasure. I'll look forward to our next visit. We'll talk about cooking one of these times, cooking wild game.
Well, maybe when everybody's got a freezer full of venison in early December, we can talk about it then. But good luck and be safe out there during the deer season.
Scott Craven, our guest, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Always great to have him come by. October Cybersecurity Month, then, we'll be talking with our consumer protection experts about how you can protect yourself by being knowledgeable. We'll also talk about Medicare enrollment fraud. That's all tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here right through the afternoon on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.